It's Wednesday, April 21st, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a look at the last 24 hours, what's happened since the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, and how we've seen it play out in our papers and on our screens. Buying in bulk how Republican politicians like Senator Josh Hawley are finding their books atop the bestseller lists. And the long-term effects of evolving technology. We've seen it in TV news. How do we preserve and archive news content knowing that we are at the mercy of file types and computers, which could all be obsolete tomorrow? But before we talk about any of that, let's go back to yesterday's verdict. I don't know where you two were when you watched it. I was in a conference room right across from my office where the nearest TV was, where a couple of colleagues came in the moment, and we ended up watching it together.
Well, I got your texts, and I was in the middle of a meeting, and then the meeting was over, and by the time I got back to my office and was able to turn on the television in my office, they were minutes away from the judge coming in and the jury being seated and the verdict coming down.
Yeah, I was listening to it on the radio.
So it's interesting. I'd be interested in hearing your take then on what you saw versus what you heard. So your reactions in watching, I know that there were split cameras at one point. At one point, the camera, the pool camera, trained directly on Derek Chauvin. Your reaction to seeing him, and then Kathy, I'm going to want to hear what your thoughts were as you were simply listening to what was happening in that courtroom.
Well, my reaction when I initially got your text was, okay, he's guilty. Having covered as many trials as I have as a reporter, if a jury comes back that quick, then you know that he's probably guilty on all charges. And so I was sort of looking for what his reaction would be. And having seen that, been in that situation and seen that happen, he had already been prepped and told, hey, you know, jury's coming back. This is probably what the
interesting.
What's
we should say that because I was talking to another colleague today, and we were very surprised by just how stoic and, in some ways, as his eyes were darting back and forth, stoic yet at the same time, almost kind of zoned out. If almost he had been prepared for that outcome, even to the point of potentially even being sedated, to be as calm as possible in that moment.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Well, and he's a cop. So, you know, he knows courtrooms as well as most lawyers or reporters would. And I think he had to have the same reaction that that we just talked about, which is you know when a jury comes back that quickly, it's not good news for the defendant. So I think he probably was prepared for this. I also think if you look at the way the trial played out, this was not a really great defense. I mean, they didn't have much to work on. And so I think, you know, I think he had to know going into this he didn't have a strong case. And then, again, he's a courtroom professional, so I think he was prepared.
Well, I mean, the other thing here is that, you know, the jury came back, 10, 11 hours? Mm-hmm. They came back with a verdict. One of the things I thought about throughout all of this was that normally, as this would have been played out, there wouldn't have even been a trial. Had he not been a police officer, had this not been caught on camera, had this not become an international incident, a prosecutor would have pled this out probably on the second degree murder charge for a lesser sentence.
I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have there ever even been charges? Go back to the first news release issued by the Minneapolis police that indicated that there was a man who had died of a medical issue after an incident. There may not have even been charges had it not been for this video recorded by Darnella Frazier.
No, absolutely.
But I think Ernest is right that once you had that video and once you saw the preponderance of evidence against Chauvin, you normally would take a plea. And I think, in fact, the prosecutor was pretty smart in this case because, unlike in some of these previous cases, rather than trying to go for murder one, he went for somewhat lesser charges, but a series of them. So this will result in a very long sentence, but it was a case that was more winnable than murder one, which is a tough thing to prove, premeditation.
Tough thing to prove. And I kept waiting to hear, maybe it was, I didn't catch all of the coverage leading up to the trial, leading up to the verdict of what were other prosecutors saying? What were these experts saying? Because somebody out there had to say, you know, and if this had been an ordinary citizen, this would have been played out. Had it not been as such a high profile case, this would have been played out. And so, you know, I also want to know how much money did they actually spend on trying this case?
I think you're making an excellent point because, first of all, it's a costly process. And particularly, we know when you have a high-profile trial, it's going to cost more to secure the courthouse, to handle the media, all of that. And the trauma that you put the community through. I mean, I saw Governor Walz interviewed last night, and he was talking about, I'm so relieved because if this had gone the other way, what would have happened in the streets. And so he had to prepare for that. Governors, mayors across the country had to prepare for that. So I think you raise a really excellent point. I mean, would this have been better? It would have been better for everybody if it had been pled out.
However, I don't know if it would have been better for everybody.
Okay.
Because
all right. I know where you're coming from.
I don't think it would have been better because, I mean, I think the governor needed this. The citizens of Minneapolis needed this. The politicians in Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota needed this. And the community in particular, the African-American community, needed this badly.
So now that they've had this, each of those parties that you're talking about, there are still three more police officers who have been charged in this case who are expected to go to trial before the end of the summer. Does that strategy of pleading it out, is that where it starts to come in now? Because you got the big fish, let's just go ahead and bring this to its end?
Right, I would not be surprised if there weren't plea bargains in all three of those other cases. And I think they will go, if you have one, then the other two will come in succession and they'll be pretty quick. And they will, I mean, I don't think that any of them can get out of serving some sort of jail time because of what's happened in Chauvin's case.
One of the other things that was interesting to me in watching the coverage, and I was watching, in the moment I was watching CNN, when I went home from work last night, I was watching MSNBC, and if I'm going to be fully honest and transparent, when it became clear to me that things were, frankly, a controlled response, I turned on Fox News for a couple of hours, wanting to see what the coverage and the reaction was there. So I kind of had that spectrum of the cable news experience. And one of the things that stood out to me, especially on CNN, and soon after when I turned the channel to MSNBC, in the immediate moments, justice was served. And as soon as everybody took a breath, there was the realization that in one case, there was a police officer who was found guilty, but we are still talking about Dante Wright. We are still talking about, and we're going to talk in depth about Adam Toledo. This was one case. What we have is accountability, not necessarily justice. And there was a very stark change in the tone and the language that was used as what had happened had begun to sink in.
Well, I think you, I think that was the message that you heard from Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota. It was definitely the message you heard from President Biden.
And the vice president.
Yes, and the vice president. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's interesting to me, and when you mentioned the Fox coverage that I thought was so interesting.
You watched it too?
I did. Yeah. And the Fox coverage was all about remarks President Biden made before the verdict came in. And the president said, I'm praying for the right verdict. And they made a big deal of that, both Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, of, you know, suggesting he was somehow jury tampering. Well, the first thing is the president said, I waited till the jury was sequestered before I made any remarks. So the jury didn't ever hear that. But the second thing that I thought was so interesting about that was so predictable. That Fox personalities, commentators would go after Biden for that. So predictable, and I'm sure Joe Biden knew that when he made those remarks. These were not ill-considered remarks. This was not the president just popping off. He very deliberately went out, chose to make remarks to reporters and chose to say what he did. And I think it's because of exactly what you said, Amy. I think it's because he is very aware that one verdict does not solve this problem. And he wanted to get that message out early and often. And I think it's so interesting because this is a guy who is of a certain age, a certain generation, who has been criticized even by his own vice president before she was vice president for being too much of an appeaser, too much of an incrementalist. And I just think he's decided enough is enough.
No, I think that he's definitely made the decision that he's going to craft the narrative in a way that speaks to the larger issues. I think that he's turned it back toward Congress to actually do something. You're not going to pin you're not going to pin this on me or my administration. As I think the way in which he's driving this, and he's also getting good direction from his vice president and others on this. And now what's going to happen is the focus, not only in terms of what happens with social justice, but also with voter registration, is going to, he's going to turn both of those narratives back on Congress and force them, working with Schumer and Pelosi, force them to deal with this issue. But he's also turning it on the press to say, this is a narrative I'm going to present, and I'm going to say to you, this is what I'm going to do. So now the news media is going to have to follow that as well. I think he's being very tactful
and,
with
and
his,
the fact,
what he's doing.
The fact that he was going to get that predictable pushback from the Fox crowd says,
right,
I don't care.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Bring it on.
Right.
So he is spoiling for this fight, and I just thought that was very interesting, and not like the Joe Biden of the 70s or the 80s, very different Joe Biden.
Right.
So there is another angle that I want to bring up on this, something that was going, frankly, as I was starting to write yesterday's show, be our lead this week. That was going to be law enforcement's handling and reaction to journalists who have been reporting in Minneapolis, especially on in the last week or week and a half or so. And I don't know if I want to use the word attacks on journalists, but an over-aggressive response to journalists, arrests and detaining of journalists. Does law enforcement in that community have a First Amendment problem?
I think I would call them attacks on journalists.
I mean,
I think it was pretty egregious, these cases. I think, and we're seeing it not just there, but everywhere where there's been street protests in the last few months, that you have reporters identifying themselves as members of the press. Now, I do understand, and this is a problem. I was on a panel about this last week, and one of the photographers was saying there is a problem that now everybody with a cell phone says they're press. And I get that is a problem for police, and I'm sympathetic to that. But these are people with credentials. And the other disturbing thing about it is journalists of color are being treated differently from journalists who are white. And we have had more than one case where a journalist was being manhandled by a law enforcement officer, despite very calmly saying, I'm a journalist. And it took a white colleague having to intervene to get that journalist out of that situation. And that says not just that there's a First Amendment problem, there's an equal justice problem here. And I just think there's a, I have to believe that a lot of this has been fueled by the anti-press rhetoric of the past couple of years. But there is this attitude that the press is the enemy. And you know, if you're doing something wrong, the press is your enemy, because we're here to witness that and attest to it. But I think this is very problematic. And I was really happy to see, again, Governor Walz issuing a really strong statement saying to his police force, mm-hmm, saying that you can't do this.
Well, you know, that's not new. And what I mean by that is even during the civil rights movement in the 50s and the 60s, you had, especially when the mainstream white press decided that that was a story back in the 50s, mm-hmm, and the 60s. You had white reporters who were helping black reporters and vice versa, depending on what the situation was. So that's been in existence for a while. And you've had police officers who have treated journalists of color differently in protest movements throughout our history. To me, it goes back to what you were talking about in terms of the press being the enemy. I think it also goes back to a lack of training when it comes to police departments. I think that you're right. You do have, now that you have this sort of anybody can be a journalist attitude out there right now, who has a cell phone and that sort of thing, and police officers are very, very nervous about being caught on camera, not only their own body camera, but now who out there has a cell phone pointed at me, they're concerned about that. You've got so much going on. I think the training of officers has to improve, and it has to adapt to the kinds of situations that they're going to find themselves in working not only with the press, but also with the public, and also among each other. Because now, because of what happened in this trial, you're going to have police officers who are going to be required, in many instances, to police their own in these situations, so that they don't find themselves being charged as an accessory to something that one of their fellow police officers did,
or to face having a fellow police officer testify against you and
absolutely.
Say flat out in an open court of law, this was excessive, this is not how we are trained, this is not what should have happened,
which was a healthy thing. But to get back to your point, I think, Ernest, the idea that I think for us as journalists, I think journalists and cops need to sit down and talk about some rules of the road, because it is a problem now when so many people are claiming the role of being in the media and then holding their cell phone up with one hand and holding their protest sign with another.
Right.
So I think that does create some real problems for cops. So how do we handle that? And I think we need to sit down and have conversations about that. And
right.
I think that's something that would be a constructive thing for both news organizations and police organizations
right.
to get involved in.
Right.
So Friday night, I stayed up watching the videos that the Chicago Police Department Civilian Office of Police Accountability released that were recorded by the body cams worn by police officers on the scene when 13-year-old Adam Toledo was shot. The officer who fired his weapon said he thought Toledo was holding a gun, a statement which has since been changed. What's remarkable about this situation has been how at least one news organization handled the publishing of these really graphic, horrific images. And Kathy, the Block Club Chicago, that's a hard one for me to get out. Block Club Chicago produced and published two different stories with bylines in different orders that the content of the stories was very similar, but the photos at the top of those online stories, very different. In one, Toledo with his hands up in that screenshot from the officer's body cam. The other, a photo of him is a kid from a memorial that was placed there. And really, those images set a very different tone for readers just in how they were able to see those.
Yeah, and I think, I may be wrong about this, but I think in that first version of the story, it was not just a still photo, but you could actually watch the video, I believe.
Okay, I will admit I didn't click on it from that point. I just saw the frame grab that was there as the image
and,
at the top.
But either way, I think even the still image caught this young man just on the verge of being shot.
Let's call him what he is. He was a 13-year-old boy. That isn't even fair to call him
13,
a man at that point. At that point, he was a 13-year-old boy.
But I think this gets into the ethics of newsroom decision making.
Yeah.
And you know, we've had frequent conversations in my classroom about this.
Yeah.
At what point does the need to show a disturbing image to, you know, we've heard about the debates over, do you show body bags coming home from war, or do you spare people that? And so I think in this case, this was a news organization that decided to give you the choice. Now, it it was very easy to click from the less disturbing version of the story over to the more disturbing one. And one of the things that makes this more problematic is that in an internet age, this is accessible to young kids. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody can click on this. So it's harder for newsrooms to control who can see. You know, back in the old days, you'd say, well, if it's after a certain hour of night, you can assume that most kids are in bed. You don't have that kind of even minimal control. And so there's no really right answer. Mm-hmm. But I think giving readers a choice and being very transparent about that is one way they were trying to get around it.
So, Ernest, I realize one organization's decision isn't necessarily indicative of a trend or of a new best practice coming to light, but you think we're going to start to see a different set of emerging standards in how we cover incidents like this?
I think you're already seeing it. And the reason you're seeing it is because there's so many distribution outlets out there. People can get that news. I mean, it goes back to what you're saying. I mean, back when the decision was made whether or not to put something out at a certain hour, you had a smaller number of outlets for which people could choose from. Now they can click on at any time, anywhere, to all of these outlets and be able to see that. And I think what we're starting to see is that you do have choice in this. And I don't think that I'm talking about the news media, has the ability to be able to control that anymore. They're going to see
That's right. And so I think that the key here is going to be educating the consumer and re-educating, and not just educating about the fact that you have a choice, but what do those choices do to you?
Right.
And, you know, all of us want to click on the most prurient, most, emotion-raising links, but is that really the best thing for you at all times? So I think it's incumbent, having a choice means having responsibility.
Right.
So I want to change topics here a little bit. Talk about something that has actually been going on here at the J School. So if you were to walk into my office, you're going to see an entire bookshelf full of old Beta tapes. Once upon a time, that was the standard in TV news. Then came a new video format called DVC Pro. And now television news is shot and recorded on memory cards, like what people use in their own digital cameras at home. Technology changes, and it changes quickly. And it's happening even more quickly on the digital news side, where file types and website redesigns wipe out content in the blink of an eye. There's this misconception, though, among readers and readers of our publications and of the public in general, that news preservation is automatic in the digital age. If it's published on the internet, there's got to be an archive of it somewhere. But according to a new project that is launching from here at the Reynolds Journalism Institute that was made and put out to the public yesterday, that is really not the case at all. And Ernest, you were saying before we started recording today's show that this is something that has been in the making for maybe even close to a decade. Talk about what the goal is here.
Well, the goal is to preserve the news and information, especially in areas that we've talked about on the show, news deserts, where that's the only news and information that you have from these small towns and areas around the country comes from those newspapers, comes from those small radio stations, that type of information. And when these newspapers and radio stations, when they close down or they're bought by someone and shut down, where does that go? Where is that history? And what we're finding out, this project started a long time ago, and now we're moving to talking about digital. When it first started out, we were trying to save the actual newspapers, either the microfilm or the newspapers themselves. And now we've progressed now we're trying to save the digital formats of these news operations. This is history. These are births, their deaths, their news that of how towns have grown or have lost their way. It's all gone if you don't figure out a way to save it.
So, Kathy, there's this misconception, and people just think, but if it's on the internet or if there's a digital file, we've got that digital file forever.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you were talking about the beta tapes. If you walk into my office, you'll see stacks and stacks of CD-ROMs, which it's very hard to find a reader for, and these are going back to the...
Oh, we don't have a beta deck anywhere in the J School. I've looked.
Yeah, so you have the artifact, but how are you going to actually see it? So we're actually in the process of digitizing old global journalist shows, and there are some really interesting shows, but it's very difficult to do. It's time consuming. It's hard because the technology changes. So I think that's the thing that this new report that was put out by Reynolds Journalism Institute with a lot of work from people here, and I want to give a big shout out to our librarian, Dorothy Karner, and our colleague, Ed McCain, who really have worked on this project, and they've been funded by the Mellon Foundation to really say, how do we, you have these organizations that are barely hanging on by their fingernails, just trying to get the news out every day, and they're not thinking about archiving. Back in the day, it was editions of the newspapers would get microfilmed and the library would take care of it. But that process of actually taking the archive and actually archiving isn't happening on a lot of websites. And so this report is looking at how do we do that. And I know one of their concerns is the ever-changing technology and how do you make sure something that was born at the dawn of the internet can still be read and accessed. So this is a really important topic, and I think you know, I hope that a lot of news organizations pay attention to the work that's being done here, because as Ernest said, this is it's the first draft of history. We want to make sure we preserve it.
I mean, and there's this expectation that, you know, your public library is going to do it, or the news organizations themselves is going to do it, or the Library of Congress is going to do it, and that's just an assumption. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you talked about it. I mean, you finding a CD reader is hard. You can't find a beta deck. Who knows what's going to come out?
It isn't even that, right? Yeah. So I have this beta deck I can't find. Forget that part of it. I even started thinking as I was looking through parts of this report about our own program here. And as I put our links blog together, am I putting enough metadata into the content management system? Or what happens when... there's already talk that NPR is changing content management systems through the entire public radio network. So what happens to all of the links blogs that have been created in the 7 years, Ernest, that you and I have been on this program, or even when Mike McKean was doing it prior, or even the shows and what was going on before we even had the Reynolds Journalism Institute?
It's very, very difficult for me to access stories I wrote for USA Today back in the 90s because their content management system has changed. And luckily, it was a big newspaper, so I can go through LexisNexis or ProQuest, one of the pay-for services. And luckily, I'm privileged to work at a university, and so I have access to that. But I think this is what we're talking about. And not every newspaper is USA Today.
Right.
So it's what about these smaller organizations or startup organizations that are online only? How is their content going to be preserved? Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's the point here, is to try to get news organizations thinking about this. And happily, there are in a lot of cases some fairly, you know, they're already on board solutions. If you just turn on a few switches, that you can actually start to save these things in a more permanent way. But it is a real problem, and it's a bigger problem. What's interesting here is it's not just news people involved in this. It's librarians, it's foundations. A lot of people realize that this is a big problem.
Okay. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. We've got a lot more that you can read about on our links blog, including that story about the bulk buying of books and how that is propping up sales and bestseller lists for Republican candidates and Republican lawmakers. You can find that under both the programs and podcast tab at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back with you next week.